From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this very special edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. As stated in the intro every week, this is the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of generational thought. And over the 13-plus years on the air, we've had many wonderful guests covering a multitude of topics. Our archive holds their perspectives, and as time goes on, and we occasionally suffer the loss of one of those guests, I think it's important to be able to honor their memory by giving ourselves a chance to really listen to what they had to say. Back on August 10th, we lost the voice of Dr. Cal Ledbetter. And prior to his death, his wife, Brownie Ledbetter, died back in March of 2010. Cal was our older generation guest on our politics program that we aired on November 7th back in 2006, which was an election night. And Brownie was our guest on the March 2004 program we did on race relations. Dr. Cal Ledbetter Jr. was a retired UALR professor here and dean and former state legislator, and he was 84 years old. He retired from UALR in 1997 after 37 years, and he was a professor, a chair of the Department of Political Science, and dean of the College of Liberal Arts. He was also a passionate student of Arkansas history and wrote extensively about the state and its political past. His voice was often heard on panel discussions around the state and on many media outlets. And very importantly, he and his wife were very strong supporters of public radio, too. Mary Brown Brownie Williams Ledbetter was a lifelong political activist who worked in many controversial and crucial campaigns in Arkansas, as well as nationally and internationally. She was a catalyst in many local grassroots organizations, and she exhibited an unfailing dedication to fair education and equality across racial, religious, and cultural lines. I went back to both their program topics and isolated their comments for this particular program. Brownie's program was Race Relations, the White Perspective, and this was a follow-up program on the previously aired topic of Race Relations, the Black Perspective. Taken together, these two programs gave us, the listeners, and now with the passage of time, a good pulse of the thoughts each race had on the topic. Brownie had spent her life working in this as well as many other important issues. Cal's program aired on election night in November of 2006, and this was a midterm election, and the issues that evening were very strident. As I isolated Cal's comments and then put them together, I really felt like his comments seemed to stand alone as a program all unto itself. As you listen to both Cal and Brownie in this program this evening, I hope you hear in their voices the dedication and service they gave to our culture, our education, our state, and our relationships. Cal and Brownie, even now as they have died, still raise their voices for us to appreciate and learn. First, we'll hear from Brownie Ledbetter on Race Relations, the White Perspective, and then her husband and life partner Cal Ledbetter on his passion, politics. I hope you enjoy the program this evening.
Our topic today is race relations from the white perspective. My guest joining me here today, representing the older generation, is Brownie Ledbetter. When you were in your younger years, what was the prevalent attitude of whites on race relations as you were growing up?
I think we were pretty much unaware that we were racist. We thought of folks in the Southeast as more racist. But I think we found out pretty quickly that we were very racist.
What were the things that kind of made you?
Well, when we had the crisis, and when he was standing on the steps along with eight other good folks, we began to feel those things. And I think it polarized this community. Some of us worked in civil rights, and some of us didn't. Some of us worked in segregation organs. But I don't think it was a generational thing.
Was it a thing that was like not even on the radar at that time, or was
what race?
Race, yes.
It was always on the radar. It was always underneath. Everybody stayed in their place, did what they were supposed to do.
Were you in the Little Rock area at the time?
Yes, I was raised here.
I know those of us who've come from other parts of the country, our levels of white interpretation of race might have been a little different than what was down here. Are you saying that those that lived in the South may have had a different attitude on race than those that lived in other parts?
No, I think Dick Gregory had it right when he said the difference is very minimal. In the North, they don't care how close you big you get is you don't as long as you don't get too close, and in the South they don't care how close you get as long as you don't get too big. So I think pretty much that was it. Obviously, we had the worst practices. we had the laws that were bad. And so the struggle was right to start here. And I think if we had not been perceived as the region with the major trouble, we probably wouldn't have made the gains we made up through the 60s and with the Civil Rights Bill and so forth and so on. But truth be known, I think it's a nationwide problem. I think it's still a very large problem.
So while the blacks were, as Dr. Roberts was talking about at that time, as they were becoming mobilized in efforts to raise the awareness levels at that particular time, were whites just not paying attention?
No, there were groups. I mean, my father, as far back as the 30s, had been very much involved in interracial group. There was the United Church Women, which now known as Church Women United, was an integrated group of women who met at Aldersgate. Very courageous group. There were efforts, but they were not terribly visible.
Was it in your generation's time, was it just black and white, or were there the other?
Well, I think that's the key issue. That's kind of white and Caucasian and African-American relations are to this country like religion is to the Middle East and like languages in Belgium. I think it's been our greatest wound and our biggest problem. And all these things, as you mentioned, other kinds of diversity, other kinds of cultural pluralism play off on that, but it's never the same. It's never quite the same as the deep wound that we have, that we, I hope, will get over someday. But it's, I've been very impressed with what the chancellor here has said, that he's done this study, and he said we can't fix racism until we face it, which is wonderful. I've always thought that, you know, we have to, we work so hard through the more active civil rights period to recognize it and to deal with it. And now we made segregation unacceptable, so people just deny their racism now. And that makes it very difficult to overcome the rather stringent vestiges that we still have.
Brownie Ledbetter, as you're looking back, what were the best things that the white race did in terms of race relations as you were going up? And what were the worst things that they did?
I don't know if I want to hash through all that. Wake up was the best thing. I think, you know, some of the changes that are really good, like seeing a little more diversity on television and so forth, also have a tough side, and that is when people see that, they figure it's okay now. And that's one of the toughest things. You know, I remember when we used to think if those things happened, actually when the 9 African-American kids were struggling to get in Central High, I remember that we were so naive, some of us white folk, that we thought once they got in, it would all be over. And when I look back at that now, I can hardly believe, you know, that we were that naive. But it took a lot of learning. We had to wake up.
The other deaths that happened during that time, was that the stuff that woke up the older generation, or was that the stuff that woke up the middle generation?
That was a horrible, horrible thing. But, you know, Medgar Evers.
Medgar Evers, yes.
When one of the most interesting things to me in my own learning was something he said before his death, which was it will come quicker in the South because we have closer relationships. They're twisted and they're wrong, but we have relationships. And I think that's true. And I think as I go around, I travel a lot as I go around the South, it is better. It's much better. And part of it is the relationship. Now, it's got a long way to go, but I don't see the kind of mingling together casually without a big brouhaha in many places in the East, in the North.
Brownie Ledbetter, as you look to the future, what does your generation think about the prospects for race relations?
I don't know about my generation, but I have a lot of hope, but it's not a good time right now. Politically, it's a terrible time. So I'm hoping for some change in that arena, and I think that'll make a difference. In my view, there really isn't an interaction between two people or among folks that somehow prejudice is not a piece of that, or race or other kinds of diversity, what's happening to many Latinos. I mean, we have in Arkansas the highest growth of Latino population in the country. Did you know that?
No.
Yes, we do. Our friends in various farm industries have gone to recruit folk in Mexico, and they are treated very poorly when they get here. It's hard to watch those kinds of things and think that we're going to have a lot of. But I have to have hope because I love this country, and I've worked in this kind of area, so you have to be an optimist if you do that.
You're listening to a rebroadcast in dedication to the memory of Dr. Cal Ledbetter and his wife, Brownie. Both were guests on our program in years past, and Brownie on the program Race Relations, The White Perspective, and Calvin in his appearance on our Politics program.
My guest with me here in the studio here today, Dr. Cal Ledbetter. He's professor emeritus who taught political science here at UALR for over 36 years, and he was teaching mainly in the Arkansas government and politics area, the American presidency, American politics, and comparative government. He'll be talking from the older generation perspective. And I'd like to begin with you, Dr. Ledbetter, in the older generation. You take us back to a time probably when politics wasn't the same as what we hear today when you hear the word politics. Go back to, as far as you can remember, and maybe even into your parents' and grandparents' time. What was politics like as you remember?
Well, one thing I'd say, Bill, I want to say that running a political campaign was much cheaper than it is today. I was in the state legislature, and I ran a campaign in 69. Guess what it cost me? $8,000.
You're kidding. Why so much?
I'm a big spender. And in those days, really, if you could devote the entire summer to campaigning for the legislature anyhow, you had $3,000 to $5,000, you could probably run a pretty good campaign. It was much simpler in those days. You didn't have consultants. Maybe you had an advertising agency, but not a consultant. And it was much easier to do things like that. Also, Arkansas, when I grew up, was basically a one-party state. Again, Democratic. And if you won the Democratic primary, in effect, the phrase was that tantamount to election meant that if you won the primary, even though you might have a Republican opponent, you still were going to win.
What years was this?
I was in the legislature 67 through 75. It was just beginning. Went to Rockefeller came in the middle 60s, just beginning to change a little bit to a two-party system. But prior to that time, it was kind of pure one-party politics.
Just a little guy growing up and thinking of your parents' time, was politics mainly a thing on the radio? Did they run ads on the radio at all?
Politics were rallies where people came, and it was big entertainment, and it was kind of like a movie in a sense. It's amazing.
So it was really politics is local, meaning politics was local.
Well, local, but also you had senatorial campaigns and you had national campaigns and that type of thing, too. But it was interesting to, you know, go out to the rallies. You don't do that anymore. But in those days, political rallies were a big draw. People would come to see and hear the candidates.
Did they want to go? I mean, did they have to drag them out?
No, I think they liked to go. It's a form of entertainment in the South, particularly in the Deep South.
When you were at one of those type of rallies back then, did you hear speeches different than you hear speeches today? I mean, what kind of language did they use? Were they using negative distance?
They would go on longer than they did to do now. I mean, now I think with John Kennedy, you had the idea that you can say what you mean 20 minutes, and that's it. In those days, you might go on an hour or so, maybe an hour, 15 minutes, amazing. We would travel around. Candidates would travel around from group to group, and groups would have political rallies, and you would talk. And as time went on, you got to know what everybody else was going to say. So this friend of mine, I talked to him once. I said, look, let's just joke. Why don't you get up and say you're me and say my talk, and I'll get up and say I'm you and say your talk. We both did it, and nobody knows anything.
Did you ever, in that particular time, recently we just had the little deal here with John Kerry misspeaking. What about misspeaking back then? Was that a big deal when it happened, or even did it happen back then?
Of course it would, but it, you know, unless you were on the radio, national radio or something like that, it really wouldn't be a big thing. I mean, you might make a mistake in front of a group and a paper might pick it up, but it wouldn't have the impact as John Kerry's talked to the other day. By the way, I did want to mention in terms of the difference in cost. We talked the other day about the two gubernatorial candidates in Arkansas today have raised $10 million. And again, the four candidates for mayor of Little Rock, in effect, a non-political job, have raised $600,000. Compared to my $8,000 30 years ago.
You know, as just a layman, and I'm just strictly a layman, when I hear these numbers bantied about, I'm wondering, where does all this money come from? Is it really coming from individuals mainly or not?
No, I think it comes from PACs and unions and groups, you know, various people like that. In those days, you could raise, as I say, if you could raise $3,000 to $5,000 and you could take the summer off and campaign, you could be a pretty viable candidate.
Did you hear candidates then with issues, or were they just mainly broad discussions of political views?
No, it would be pretty good. They would talk about what they wanted to do, if they got in the legislature, what kind of legislation they would want to introduce, that type of thing. It was fairly substantive, all told.
Were the candidates subject to a lot of personal scrutiny back then? Did they do a lot of digging into their backgrounds and that sort of thing?
They were subject to a lot of political scrutiny. Bill, what you would have, of course, you would appear before various groups, labor unions, Chamber of Commerce, Farm Bureau, and they would interview interview you about where you stood on issues, and they would decide whether or not to endorse you or not. And at the end, they would send out a sheet in terms of how they rated you. But there wasn't what you're talking about. There wasn't the kind of personal scrutiny. In other words, to what extent were you identified with the interest group? Did they pay for vacation for you? Did you have state contracts? That scrutiny was not around. And that needed to be changed, and I think it was by that initiated act, Common Cause, way back there.
Well, after listening to you talk about the things that you just did and knowing that you spent your life in political science, when did you begin to notice that there was a science to politics?
Well, I'm not sure there's a science. Science only just says, Phil, you could run a scientific poll, that type of thing. And there are certain studies that show you things. But in essence, political science is much more a matter of judgment than anything else.
So in those earlier years, it really didn't matter for all the analysis that we hear today?
Oh, I think that helps. But again, as I say, in essence, anybody can judge politics any way they want to, I think. It was so different in my generation in the sense that, for one thing, it was a much more nonpartisan type thing. For example, when Winthrop Rockefeller became governor, he had, as I remember, one Republican senator and three Republican representatives. So he couldn't possibly have enough Republicans to carry his, as we say in the legislature, carry his laws. So people in Pulaski County, including myself, in Washington County, Democrats, helped support his legislation, helped carry his legislation in a bipartisan way. And you did that, and the Democrats would not disown you. And yet that would be unheard of today. So you also, if you pull somebody in the legislature, which you did frequently on bills, you didn't feel like you needed to destroy them. You know, all you want to do is defeat them on a particular bill, and you might be a friend of theirs on another bill 2 weeks down the pike. You're not going to destroy them. You know?
So that's where the phrase that we hear so many times, my friend so-and-so and my friend so-and-so.
Yeah, yeah.
They're really not friends today, but they might have been friends
right.
in your time.
And they might be an ally of yours tomorrow, you know.
Mm-hmm. But I'm interested about when that change happened. Did it happen with the consent of the older generation, Dr. Ledbetter? Did you guys just recognize all of a sudden that you'd lost power?
Well, I think, obviously, you saw the first post-World War II generation, GIs, coming back. Like, this was a huge impact in Arkansas. You mentioned Sid McMath. I mean, the GIs came back after World War II and just seized power. They came back with the idea that we're going to clean up politics. Sid McMath was a great motivating force for this. And so I suppose in that sense, they just seized the moment and took it.
So there was probably something, I guess you'd say, between the GIs and the boomers, the silent generation, when they were in control. That group that's between you guys, the politics, is that where the politics changed right there so that the 60s could happen the way it did?
You know, I think what you had Eisenhower in the 50s, Eisenhower was a very non-polarizing figure, a very acceptable figure to Democrats as well as Republicans. And I think he kept that kind of GI sentiment and unity from World War II intact, and then it comes in the 60s, and again, not so much to break the unity of World War II, but Kennedy says, you know, it's this new generation, we've got new ideas, new thoughts, and different.
Well, we really didn't get a boomer generation president until Mr. Clinton came along, and that's quite a period of time between the 40s through the 60s and through the 80s till we ended up with the first baby boomer president.
Do you think that my generation sometimes, particularly the post-World War II people, had the idea that you hear it in bumpers, for example, in Sid McMath, that politics is a very honored profession. I mean, you need to go in politics because it's one of the most honored things you can do. And you don't hear that much anymore, and that's unfortunate, I think.
Well, that's one of the questions I was going to ask, and I'll ask it now. In your generation, Dr. Ledbetter, the GIs, and even older than that, why did people serve? Why did people want to serve in politics?
I think they read politics as part of what you owe society. In other words, if you live in society as wealthy and successful as ours and as peaceful as ours, then you owe something to that society. You owe service to that society. And one way you can serve is through the military. And there are other ways, too. But if you talk about military service, I think that's a large part of it. The World War II generation had a really great sense of optimism that you don't find today. I mean, here's a generation that won World War II, that rehabilitated Europe, that set the parameters beyond which the Russians couldn't go, NATO, all these things. These
came out of the Depression.
Yeah, these are marvelous things. And I think they created an art of atmosphere that's just not present anymore, and that's unfortunate, I think.
Well, I'm thinking of my parents as they watched me grow up, and parents watch their kids grow up. Dr. Ledbetter, speaking from a parental stage, looking at the at the boomers when they were young, were you prepared to see them come into politics the way that they are now? And what would you say is the GI generation's outlook on the boomers and the way that they are stepping up?
I don't know how the whole generation would look at it. I've taught school, and I'm very impressed with students today and how they operate. I don't have any problems with the boomer generation. I think it's going to work out right. I do miss one thing. First of all, everybody in my age group, every male, had military service of some kind. And that's a great unifying thread, you know. Everybody's been in the Army, and that's no longer there. And I don't know if that ties you together or what, it just gives you common experiences, but it's just some commonality we simply lost, and I hate to see that. But it's just going to be, I think, given the education of the new generation, the way they approach things, I think it's going to be all right.
Well, we're talking about politics today here on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. I'm Phil Marriage. My guests are Dr. Kyle Ledbetter. He's speaking from the older generation. He's Professor Emeritus here at UALR. Dr. Ledbetter, I'd like to ask you a question about the terms that we hear bandied about a lot and have you think about how they were when you were younger, liberal and conservative. Does it mean different now, or what did it mean for your generation?
You know, when I was in the legislature, Phil, you didn't hear so much liberal conservative. What you seemed to hear was, again, whether you're a spender or a non-spender. In other words, a spender would be somebody in those days who was concerned about fully funding state services or maybe even introducing new state services. And a non-spender was a guy that really came in and his whole mission in the legislature was make sure we don't spend any money. So you had that kind of conflict. And yet urban-rural conflict, which is seems to me not quite as pronounced as it used to be. So I'd say spinners and non-spinners rather than liberal-conservative, or maybe it amounts to the same thing.
So those were the terms you heard back then. You didn't hear the liberal...
Yeah, you'd hear it, but it seems to me what it really boiled down to was how much you wanted to spend, basically.
So they weren't fighting words?
No, not really, I would think. Civility is very important. It really is a civil dialogue. And I remember, this is not the older generation necessarily, but I remember I was a Peace Corps advisor on campus, and you wouldn't believe the hundreds of kids who came in for the Peace Corps. Just amazing.
Well, of course, you're talking about that boomer generation,
yeah.
And they were definitely a very idealistic generation at that time anyway. Let me ask you, Cal, a little bit about the word that comes to mind when I think about politics a lot that I don't hear bandied about at all, and that's the pendulum. It seems to me like there is a pendulum involved with politics. It swings one way and then swings another. When you were younger, and where was the pendulum then?
Of course, when I was growing up, the South was predominantly Democratic, and again, the whole nation was a New Deal nation. And then it swung, I guess, to Eisenhower in the 50s, which was not completely conservative, but much more conservative than the New Deal. And then you swing back with Kennedy, and then we've had, conservative government, except with the exception of LBJ. So it does swing back and forth. In fact, you're seeing me right now. I assume the Democrats are going to, if they don't take both houses, they're going to certainly make gains, and that's certainly a case of the pendulum coming back again. So it does tend to come back and forth every now and then.
I'm thinking about the word dedication and commitment for each of us in the various generations as we look at politics. And I'm thinking of my grandfather, who was a Yellow Dog Democrat, he would never think at all about voting for a Republican for anything. And in the 60 election with Kennedy, his issue was the fact that he was a Catholic. And he struggled on this one particular issue because he would never vote against a Democrat for any reason at all. And to my knowledge, he did vote for Kennedy, but I guess he held his nose, as we hear that phrase there. But my parents on the other side, they were, and they still are, Republican. So I saw a generation in my grandparents of strong Democrats, my parents' generation, and they're still strong Republicans. And then I come along, and I guess I'd say I'm pretty much on that, like you'd say, would say left of center if I had to define something there. Maybe more of the independent than my parents were, because they would vote strictly Republican no matter what, just like my grandfather would have voted strictly Democrat. Cal Ledbetter, is that dedication and commitment something that was part of your generation that you guys just had in you?
You know, I am really encouraged, though. Did you see many aspects in politics that do encourage me? That is the acceptance of people who probably would not have been accepted in my generation. My generation, you probably could not have elected a Catholic as president. But you can, and that certainly is to the good. You didn't see blacks running for office, and certainly you do now. You didn't see women, and that's all to the good, I think. And I think it's a tribute to American politics that we have been accepting of other people. And this certainly is going to continue, I think, as time goes on. And it's a credit to the American people. It works out that way.
So dedication and commitment was a strong factor for your time.
Yeah, and also in my time, it would have been almost not quite impossible, but a divorced person would have had a hard time running for major office. And that's certainly not true today. Not true at all.
Dr. Ledbetter, you led off the program with mentioning that Arkansas was pretty much a one-party state. When you look at the politics in Arkansas across the generations here, what do you see has been the timeline for politics in Arkansas?
I'd say probably it began, you've always had Northwest Arkansas, which has always been a kind of Republican enclave way back there, coming from the Civil War. But prior to that, it's been, besides Northwest Arkansas, as we talked about, it's been a one-party state. I guess what brought the two-party system to Arkansas is went to Rockefeller. And again, the fact that people seemed to like him and felt, you know, he didn't have horns on and was a pretty nice guy. And he brought in a lot of money to the Republican Party. And I think from the 60s and 70s on, the Republican Party began to make inroads in Arkansas. It's still, obviously, Arkansas is still the local infrastructure, the county judges and sheriffs, they're still predominantly Democrats. The legislature is still predominantly Democratic. But there are Republican inroads. And I'd say it started with Rockefeller. And I guess it comes from spreads from Northwest Arkansas down a little bit to Central Arkansas, places like that.
Well, when you look at American history from the get-go, over the course of time, in a much broader picture than in just our few generations that we're looking at right here, the politics has changed drastically from that period of time till right now. Dr. Ledbetter, I'm going to ask you this question. As you look at the overall picture of American history, is there change ahead that is as broad a change as that we saw in the past coming in the future, as you see it?
Could be, Phil. I see one change I don't really like, and that is the idea, you've heard the idea of the concentration on basically one issue. And I'm afraid what that means in the future for American politics is eventually we're going to go to the European system, with the exception of the English, where in Europe, basically you have one party for one interest group. You have one party for the farmers, one for the teachers, one for the businessmen, et cetera. And we'll lose that continuity and compromise you had through the two-party system. And that worries me, and I'm afraid that's coming.
If you had to describe your generation in political terms with one word, what is the word that would describe your generation's politics?
I'd say dedicated. I mean, this is the generation that went through World War II, as I mentioned before, that came back and instituted the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine and NATO, all these types of things. And then, as we mentioned, particularly here in Arkansas, the generation came back and launched the GI Revolt in Arkansas, which tried to clean up politics. It's been a great generation. See, I think it's a very dedicated, idealistic generation.
Do you have a word that you would use to describe the middle or the, and then also the younger generation?
I'll let them describe themselves.
I'll take a shot.
Is there not a word that comes to your mind to describe?
Middle generation, I would say, hardworking. I'm trying to think, I need a better word than that to describe the middle generation. Maybe pragmatic.
How about the younger generation?
I would still say idealistic. I hope it is.
I hope you've enjoyed this respectful rebroadcast of the programs featuring Cal Ledbetter and his wife, Brownie. Cal died on August 10th this year, and his wife, Brownie, died back in 2010. They were guests on our program topics, Race Relations, The White Perspective, and Cal's topic was the program on politics. I've posted both original programs which had the other guests for those topics, and those postings are on our program page at KUAR.org. Just click on Programs and go to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. You'll find the link there for these podcasts. Thanks for listening this evening, and we'll see you next week.
Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.